This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 5th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. I'm joined today by writer Mark Mason to discuss three books of his choosing. On our bookshelf today, we have three non-fiction works, one that investigates how we started to give new meanings to old words, another looking at the enduring appeal of the royalty in Britain, and finally a collection of 125 era-defining letters from across history. That's all to come here on the Monocle Arts Review on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show, Mark. We're going to start with Caroline Taggart's new book, New Words for Old, Recycling Our Language for the Modern World. The book talks about how certain words have been adapted and changed over time. First of all, what did you make of this study?
I loved it. It's one of those, language is always a winner. You know, we use these words all the time, and books like this tell you about the words that you use all the time without really thinking about why you use them. Tabloid, for instance, tabloid newspaper. You just, when you stop and think about it, it's a really weird sounding word, but you just use it all the time. You go, yes, a tabloid, that's, the Sun's a tabloid, the Times isn't a tabloid. And you forget that this word must have come from somewhere. It turns out it comes from the 1880s, and it was a medical term originally. There was a company that uses, that used to manufacture compacted medicines. They were called Burroughs and Wellcome. They were in London, pharmaceutical firm, and they made, as well as making medicinal things in compacted form, they made tea tablets. They would get compacted tea leaves into a little tablet, like a medicinal size, and each one was enough for a single cup of tea. And so that was a tablet, but because it was small, it was a tabloid. You know, okay, that the oid means small. And so you think, well, why would it, a tabloid, where did those first four letters come from in a newspaper? And there's explanations like that. And also, you know, pixel. We all use the word pixel the whole time now. Never actually stopped to think. It's a really strange word. It actually is a combination of picture and element.
Very nice. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's weird. It's one of those books that answers the questions that you never even stopped to ask in the first place.
Right. I mean, I was going to say, because I think there are quite a few books that do this, you know, sort of say, you know, how, look how fluid language is. And I feel like we already know that. But is this kind of pushing new ground for you, do you think?
Well, yeah, because a lot of them are coming to be used in modern. I mean, pixel, obviously, is coming to be used in a different sense. And then a word like spam. Spam, we now associate with, you know, it's unwanted email, spam email. We all know what it means now. But it turns out it's got two previous lives. First of all, it's a meat product. It's a commercially available meat product. It's the trade name of that. And you don't stop to think, why was it called spam? It's actually spiced ham. That's where it came from in the first place. And then its second life was in the famous Monty Python sketch of spam, spam. So there's a cafe where all they serve is spam. Spam, 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 eggs, beans and spam. And then the reason it had its third life, the one that we know now, unwanted email, is because a lot of the people, the geeks, the techno geeks, who set up email systems and were into computers at a very early age, you know, the internet especially in the 90s, but even back into the late 80s, they were all, because of their nerdy side, they were all Monty Python fans.
Right.
And so they remembered that sketch of just all this unwanted stuff coming in was similar to the spam, 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 spam sketch in Monty Python. So I love it that a word can have not just one, not even two, but three lives.
Fantastic. So yeah, this is, we're talking about new words for old. I mean, how do you think Caroline Taggart did this? I mean, what made her choose this selection of words, do you think? Did she say in her introduction or anything?
I think wherever there's an interesting story, it's right. Obviously, I mean, her previous books are like that as well. You know, she's driven by the material in terms of, she hasn't always written about words. She's written books aimed at teaching you all the things that you'd forgotten from school.
Yeah, that's wonderful. 2008, she had I Used to Know That, which is about stuff you forgot from school.
Yeah.
Which is a very nice idea, actually, because, yeah.
They always bring out the kid in you, these books. Right. The things that make you laugh. And things, like I say, the questions you never stop to ask. Chauffeur, the French, it's obviously a French word, but it's become to, you know, we all know what a chauffeur is now, driving us around. But it turns out that it's actually the French verb for to heat. And a chauffeur originally came from the trains, not from cars. On the trains, the chauffeur was a fireman as well as the driver. He was the one that would keep the fire going on the old steam trains.
Fascinating.
So that's where the word comes from. Again, you don't even stop to think about it. And deadline as well. Those of us that write for a living or anyone involved, we all have deadlines, applications for university or whatever. There's always a deadline. Turns out the original deadline was in the American Civil War, the 1860s. It was the line that they drew around a military prison. And if you were an escapee, if you got over that line, you would then be shot. Wow. It was literally a deadline.
So at the end of this book, I mean, what's the kind of final conclusion that Taggart seems to reach? It seems to be a kind of a look at modern society, a clever look at modern society through words, basically, through language.
And the ones that you take for granted. That's what I love about it, is that we live, and new words are coming, especially with new technology. They're coming up the whole time. New words are being invented. And it sort of takes you back and makes you question these things that go by. Otherwise, you'd never stop to notice them.
Fantastic. New Words for Old, Recycling Our Language for the Modern World by Carolyn Taggart is out now, published by Michael O'Mara. Let's move on now to Royalty Incorporated, Britain's best-known brand, by Stephen Bates, who used to be the royal correspondent for The Guardian. It's a shrewd analysis of the enduring appeal of the royal family in Britain and the reasons behind our continuing love affair with them. Mark, what did you make of this one?
Fascinating. It was, again, one of those things that you take for granted. The royal family, we take them for granted. And until you just assume that they've always been there and that they've never changed. And what this book cleverly points out is that the royals' own term for what they've been doing is the Marmite label strategy, or the Marmite jar strategy, which is that Marmite's very British product. It's famous around the world. Wherever British people go, they take Marmite with them because it's the one thing you can't buy abroad. And it's this old, it's made from brewer's yeast. It's something you spread on toast. It's sort of a relishy type of product. Or spread, that you would probably call it. And it's one of those things that's been around for literally centuries now. I think it's over 100 years old. And you think that the label has never changed. It's one of those unchanging parts of the British landscape. You think the Houses of Parliament have always been there. They're 150 years old. But, you know, you think they've always been there. Nothing's ever changed. And you look closely at the Marmite label. It's constantly changing the whole time. And the royal family do that. You know, the Queen has now been Queen for famously 63 years. She's just overtaken Victoria, longest reigning monarch ever. The way that she has kept this so-called timeless institution relevant is by changing very, very subtly. For instance, when her father used to go and open shopping centres and get in touch and go out on walkabouts and go and shake hands with people, that's not how society was then. But she knows that society has changed, and so her institution has had to change. And her phrase for it is, I have to be seen to be believed. She has to get out there, she has to shake the hand, she has to go and open the shopping centre, now she even poses for selfies with people. There was a small girl taking a selfie as she walked past the other, and the Queen deliberately stopped so that she could be in the shot. So she knows what she's up to. Very, very clever woman. And then it also takes you back through the centuries as well to show you how things have changed, but how they haven't. William the Conqueror raised his helmet at Hastings. He was obviously the conquering one coming in, defeating the then incumbent, as you would say, and raised his helmet at Hastings to show that he was still alive. It was the equivalent 1,000 years ago of the Queen's I have to be seen to be believed. You know?
Fascinating. I mean, lots of people consider this a bit of a golden age for the royalty in this country. There was obviously a pretty rocky period following the death of Princess Diana, but the royal wedding in 2011 has kind of marked a new sort of high point, I guess. Does Bates agree with that, or has he got a more nuanced view?
He has. I think he's aware all the way through the book. I mean, I loved the book because I particularly dislike Prince Charles, and you get the feeling as Bates is going through that he has that feel as well. Prince Charles does not come out well from this book. He cites a recent tour of the Middle East or the Gulf States, I think, that Charles was on. It was earlier this year, 2015. And Charles was on the same plane as all the journalists for several days, getting on and off the plane several times a day, flying around. Not once did Charles even acknowledge the journalist's presence. Never mind say hello to or come back down. And, you know, famously Blair and all the Clinton and presidents like that. And the more touchy-feely royal, the ones that the royals that have got a sense of their own image are prepared to do that. Charles won't do it. So it depends which way it goes. You know, if Charles takes over and takes that sort of approach, maybe things could change. Everyone seems to love the Queen. And I love the little details. You know that this book has obviously been written with a lot of research. The details, things like the state coach, the Diamond Jubilee state coach, which was the one they built for the Diamond Jubilee a couple of years ago, that was built to look like the old ones. And it looks as you could imagine it was, you know, William IV or someone riding around in it. It's got electric windows.
So that's the Marmite.
They are subtly changing. It's lovely little details like that.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the relationship between journalists and Prince Charles. There was a really amazing documentary a couple of months ago about the royal family's relationship with the media. And it seemed incredibly, I mean, to me, it seemed incredibly kind of old-fashioned and almost undemocratic, this thing. That, you know, they had these kind of perfect press events where you'd only get your 2 minutes and there was a very, like, everyone knew what they were going to say. And I felt like, you know, we would actually balk at that if it was taking place in the Middle East or Africa. But yet we were completely fine with it when it's the royal family.
Yeah, like I said, I think they are subtly changing. The Queen's aware of mobile phones and cameras on them and that sort of thing. And I think they're also changing in the way they treat their own staff. The Queen has a box at the Royal Albert Hall, which is it's split up in the private boxes there. You can own one. Anyone can buy one. They cost a lot of money, but anyone can own one. And then if you don't want your tickets for it, you can sell them on. And so obviously the Queen doesn't want to go to the pop concerts at the Royal Albert Hall. So she lets her staff have the tickets. Until a few years ago, to be a staff member one of the Queen's staff members at a pop concert there, you had to wear a suit and tie, even if it was to go and see Take That or someone. Now she's relaxed that rule. She knows that it's changing. I think gradually there, you can't change too much because otherwise you stop being that centuries old institution. But equally, you have to change a little bit, otherwise you stay trapped in those past centuries.
Right, and what does Bates kind of imagine is the future of the monarchy in Britain? I mean, he obviously has enormous respect for the Queen and her sort of strategy, but what does he think the future holds for the institution?
I think he's aware that it could go either way. Like I said, he's obviously no great fan of Charles. And if assuming that Charles is our next king, you know, Charles is going to be, if he becomes king, will become the oldest monarch ever crowned in this country. He's been waiting that long. You know, the Queen has been on the throne that long. His mum's been holding him up for that long. So it could change. It depends on the people involved. That's the whole point of, you know, I always get slightly confused when people say, oh, isn't the Queen lovely? What a brilliant lady she is. Therefore, that proves the monarchy is a good thing. Well, you haven't really thought through the hereditary principle there, have you? You get who you're given. That's the hereditary principle. I think it could go either way. I think Harry seems to be, Bates always refers in the book that Harry is, if Charles does any length of time, and then William, and then William's kids, they all seem to be liked. They're all part of the, you know, William's popular. He's not box office like the Queen is, but he seems to be a nice enough guy. And that'll take them through most of this century. So I think for the coming decades, things seem to be pretty well set up.
That was Royalty Incorporated, Britain's Best Known Brand by Stephen Bates, which is out now, published by Aurum Press. Mark, your final choice on today's book review is More Letters of Note, Correspondence Deserving a Wider Audience. It's compiled by Sean Usher. It's a collection of 125 historically significant epistles and is the follow-up to the 2013 bestseller Letters of Note. First off, Mark, what was it that kind of drew you to this anthology?
It certainly makes its presence felt with you, this book. I weighed it. I don't often weigh books, but it's so big. I measured the covers as well. The hard covers are 28.9 by 21 centimetres. It weighs 1.62 kilograms, this book. It's a serious... It's coffee table size. It's a big book. You certainly don't read it from beginning to end, because apart from anything else, that would remind you that the book had to end. This is one of those books that you love so much, you don't want it to end, so you don't want to see how far you've got through it. You flick through it, and the sheer variety is what makes it great. That, you know, there can be letters from someone you've never heard of, someone writing into a kids' TV programme, letters from John Lennon to Eric Clapton asking him to join the Plastic Ono band. And then the really curious thing about that is that when they reproduce, there's always a transcript. So handwriting is never going to be a problem. Even when you can't read the handwriting, there's always a transcript there. But John Lennon's handwritten letter to Clapton asking him to join the band. And for some reason, he has changed of late to lately. I think Lennon's saying something like, we're always keeping up with what you're doing, Eric. We love your music. And we know what you've been doing of late, and then crosses it out and puts lately. And it's a strange little change. Why would you make that? You know, obviously, well, Lennon, famous for his use of words. And then there are the things like the sign-offs, how people choose to end their letter. There are some fairly formal letters in there that end yours sincerely, yours faithfully. Spike Milligan writes to George, back to the Beatles again. Spike Milligan writes to George Harrison and finishes with love, light and peace, which is the sort of thing, you know, a comedian would say to a rock star.
Right.
The filmmaker Hollis Frampton is writing to the Museum of Modern Art, who've basically written to him and said, can we put on a show of your work but not pay you anything for it? And Frampton writes back with a very well argued, it's not abusive, it's a very well argued, no, come on, you're going to pay me for this. That's how life works. You do your work and you get paid for it. But he still finishes it with benedictions at the end instead of, you know, yours sincerely or whatever. And then one of my favourites was Marge Simpson writing to First Lady Barbara Bush, the first President Bush's wife, had criticised the Simpsons. So the show's writers wrote a letter from Marge Simpson to Barbara Bush with some disparaging comments, you know, saying, argue, again, very elegantly arguing back about the disparaging comments. And the letter ends, "with great respect."
Fantastic. I mean, so these are really covering kind of a lot of different historical eras. And I mean, it's a huge timescale that it's covering.
Oh, yeah. It goes back certainly into the 19th century. I think there's earlier than that as well. And back into some of the mid-20th century is where, because you've got a knowledge of the events involved, that's when the letter can shed light on something you thought you knew and can be quite spooky, actually. There's an American army guy, Lieutenant Richard Helms, or Lieutenant, as they would say in America, Lieutenant Richard Helms, writes to his three-year-old son, because Lieutenant Richard Helms has been into Hitler's bunker and has got, or certainly has got hold of some of Hitler's letterheads, a little postcard printed, adult, you know, the few, and writes to his three-year-old son on one of the cards, which is a spooky enough thing to do in the first place. But the card reads, "The man who might have written on this card once controlled Europe. Today he is dead. His memory despised." He manages to misspell despised, by the way. "His country in ruins, but thousands died that it might be so. The price for ridding society of bad is always high. Love, Daddy."
That's quite a memento from your dad.
I know. I wonder what the kid did with it. Yeah. Well, he's obviously still got it because it's in the book.
Right, yeah.
What a spooky thing to do.
What an amazing collection. I mean, it's a very nice idea, I guess, to chart a course through history using letters, because it's often so intimate. You know, it's an intimate way of writing. Do you feel like the intimacy is part of the attraction of the letter?
Absolutely. You know? I mean, some of the best ones are that people are writing because Rachel Carson is who died of... she was a biologist and she died very young of cancer, and wrote to a friend, and she herself in the letter put, "The thought was something I can write better than I can say." So that's the reason she was writing, and the letter gives you time to put it down. There's also the distance. If you've got something awkward to say to someone, if you do it in writing rather than in the flesh or over the phone, it's a lot easier to do. Dorothy Parker sends her editor a telegram instead of telephoning because she says, "I can't look you in the voice."
Very nice. That was More Letters of Note, Correspondence Deserving a Wider Audience by Sean Usher, and that's out now, published by Canongate Unbound. And that, I'm afraid, brings us to the end of today's show. Mark Mason, thank you very much for joining us today. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. My producer was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for this week's film review, but for now, thanks very much for listening and goodbye.